two. Welcome back on this Friday night. All right, Mr. C, where do we go next here?
Okay, well, I just checked my email, and we've got a few people wanting memberships. I've also got one from somebody wanting to know if I want to meet them on a date. No, I'm not going to do that.
What's his name?
No, it ain't a him. It's a nice-looking young lady, but we'll leave that go. Okay, now we got the two documents, 5A and B.
Notice how he offered to send that to me?
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
I know it gets probably cold and lonely up there in Oregon. Down here in Florida, well,
I know, it's hot and sweaty. Okay, we'll leave it there.
Last Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I had to scrape ice off my windshield.
Come on, in Florida?
Yeah, yeah.
Off the Corvette?
Down in Miami.
Not off the Corvette.
No, it's covered up. It's covered up. I don't take it out if it's crummy weather.
Right, it's too red. It'll scare people. I know.
Well, not only that, if the streets are wet, you know, those things like to swap ends even on dry streets because they're overpowered.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I drive it, you know, we push the button a lot.
Got it. All right. 5A, we're looking at something.
5A and 5B are the same thing. It's a surrender document. And the other one, which is in Spanish, which I didn't put up there, not necessary. We got copies of these from Captain Wermuth. These are the documents that he signed when he surrendered his boat in Mar del Plata, Argentina. In July of 1945.
So this is a surrender document.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he said, and here I'm looking back at the email from Pizarro. Pizarro says, I asked him about passengers, which would be Hitler, Eva
right.
Braun, etc.
Right.
Aboard U-530, and Wermuth said to me, no, I had no passengers on my U-530. So I asked him about cargo or cases of anything aboard U-530, and Wermuth said to me, no, we had no cargo or cases of anything, only torpedoes and food and six big rubber boats. I asked him about the crew members aboard U-530, and he said he thought in Kiel they had 56 crew members aboard, but after they left Horten, Norway, they had only 54 crew members aboard. Towards the end of the war, they had more than normal complement of men. Usually a Type 9 had about 48 men aboard, but because they had increased anti-aircraft guns, they had a few extra gunners aboard. So that is the surrender document.
Wow.
And as I say, we got this right from Captain Wermuth. How many other people get their research right from the guy who was there? Nobody.
Didn't happen. No.
Right.
All right.
So who's number six? Okay, there's a very famous guy that nobody ever heard of. You'll notice he's got the Knight's Cross around his throat.
Mm-hmm.
And down on his pocket, he's got the Iron Cross. And what warship was he in command of? Number seven. That was his warship. Mm. That was Garber's. So here we'll continue. And we've talked about Garber's on your show.
In other words, photo number seven was his warship.
That is correct.
All right.
So here's what Pizarro said in his next email. Dear friend Harry, thank you for all the good words from you and Shark Hunter members for my crazy heart illness and your prayers. I have many tears in my eyes. And then he says, the photo, that was the photo of U-530. He said he got that in the 1990s from one of his crewmen. And so Pizarro continues. He says, I told him, Wermuth, that the Miramar Lighthouse was the destination of Commander Heinrich Garber's. That's the photo you saw of that man.
Number six.
Motor sailor.
Yeah.
Say again?
Number six. He's got a motor sailor there. Okay.
Right.
And you look on top of the rear mast, and you can see a German flag.
Yeah, don't look at that swastika too long. Your brain melts.
Oh, my. I have a headache already. All right.
Yeah. That boat for the sailors is yawl rigged. That's not catch. That's a yawl. And 90 tons. So anyhow, he goes continues, he says, that was the destination, the Miramar Light, of the motor sailor Passim in July 1944 with 10 tons of cargo and two fresh German spooks for Argentina. Passim came back to Germany with three German spooks from Argentina, and they landed at Vigo, Spain, in 1944. For this patrol, Garbers received the Knight's Cross in 1944 in Berlin, and his crew received the Iron Cross First Class. Wermuth said the story was new to him, and he never heard about Passim. And we've discussed that on your show before, that boat Passim had made trips in and out of Argentina quite frequently,
right,
using the home port of Vigo, Spain. And they were, because it was wood that didn't pop up on radar, and they would run equipment, spies, agents.
Well, look at the electronics. Look at the antennas up there on the top.
Yeah. Doesn't look like your typical fishing boat, does it?
No.
Well, there was a movie, or a series, a TV series before your time in the 50s called The Wackiest Ship in the Army, in which that was paralleled, only the show was about a U.S. Navy sailing ship like this.
Uh-huh.
Gary something or another was the skipper. I forget the guy who was the Army specialist on board, but they were pretending to be just fishermen. And if a plane would come by, they'd all dive down below and come up wearing straw hats and all that. Apparently they paralleled this. So I mentioned that they had six big rubber boats on board. One of the big mysteries, which Wermuth would never
on board U-530.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wermuth would never answer the question. The number six rubber boat was missing. What happened to it? And when they were sitting at the table, Charlie Grützemacher and Pizarro, when Wermuth would be talking about his mission, Pizarro said Charlie would always smile and say, "Yeah, but what happened to the number six rubber boat?" Nobody has an answer for that. So maybe somebody rowed ashore, but the Wermuth keeps saying, nope, he had nobody on board to row ashore.
Well, that's called honor and discipline. So,
yeah, Pizarro says later on that maybe some of the guys took it to go fishing with or something. Who knows?
Right.
So we look down to photo 8. That's a photo nobody else has. Our guy down in South America, Martin Gomez, got this out of the archives, the Navy archives down there, the Argentine Navy archives,
mm-hmm.
and sent it to us. Martin is the guy who takes me around. He finds all sorts of places. He's the one that, when we were down there in February of 16, he's the one that found the young fella, well, 40-year-old roughly, who was the grandson of Reimer Horton, one of the two Horton brothers.
That's an astonishing find.
Yeah. And so we're in contact with him. Yeah. We're also in contact with his father, who was Reimer Horton's son.
Uh-huh.
The two brothers, the Horton brothers, who built the jet-powered flying wing stealth bomber for Germany.
HO-229.
Yep. And we've got pictures of one of them flying over the Brazilian rainforest.
It's an amazing picture. That's by the way, that picture, that photograph of a U-530 shows you what sleek boats those were.
Mm-hmm.
Get an idea. Like
a sliver of steel.
Yeah. Yeah. Remarkable.
Yeah, so.
Okay, picture number 9.
Picture number 9, okay. We're coming to that here. I'm flipping paper and talking at the same time.
If you want to quote anything from Pizarro, go ahead at any time, any of his emails. So just go ahead.
Okay. Well, right now we're out in the open, but as we get further into this, there's things that I'm not going to talk about too much. But Anyhow, here's more of this email from Pizarro. He says, about rubber boat number 6, Wermuth said nothing more to me, but in the last email to you, I forgot. Wermuth told me that during the time in the shipyard to have the cutouts put in the foredeck, they also put in a snorkel. He said, when the boat surrendered in Mar del Plata, it is possible that rubber boat number 6 was defective or malfunctioned. So, and Charlie Grutzemacher said it's possible some of the crew went fishing for fresh fish and the rubber boat was defective.
So these rubber boats were inside and they were brought out and inflated.
Yep. They had,
like a Zodiac.
Well, not inside so much. They had little canisters on the deck.
I see.
And watertight canisters, about like a torpedo tube, only vertical and maybe only about 3 feet long. And they would open the watertight door when they were surfaced, and there'd be the lifeboats inside, the rubber boats.
Right.
So then we switch gears a little bit. We are learning so much more about this big six-engine plane. There were...
Last picture, number 9.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's the crew as they were surrendering in Mar del Plata. The guy there with the little cap on who looks like he's looking over his right shoulder up into the sky somewhere, that's Wermuth.
Look at what he looks like, a captain. He looks like a man in charge. He's wearing his Iron Cross.
Yeah, his Iron Cross first, and above that is he had a front spanga, which was rare for the U-boaters because they didn't introduce the front spanga, that's a close combat clasp, until late in the war. They had the bronze and they had the silver, whereas the Army and the Air Force also had gold, but theirs was introduced earlier on.
Right.
So... But that's where Wermuth and the rest of his crew, as they were surrendering down in Mar del Plata.
Young boys.
He was only 24 when he was skipper of the boat.
Well, look at the guys next to him. Look like they're 18, 19 at the most.
Right. Towards the end of the war, 23 was the average age of a skipper. And 19 was the average age of a...
And tell our listeners, Harry, how many men did not come back who were in the U-boat service.
That's a tragedy, almost as bad as the U.S. Navy submarine guys. The U.S. Navy submarine guys lost 1 man out of 7, and the German submarine guys lost 6 men out of 7. 1 guy came home out of 7.
That's it.
Almost 30,000 people didn't come home, but we found no evidence ever of anybody deserting. They all...
And I understand, even at the end of the war, they were lined up around the block to get in, to
yeah,
sign up.
Yeah, they were still signing up. We've
volunteer.
Got members. Rolf, don't need to mention his last name. he lives fairly close to me here. He was in training, in U-boat training, when the war ended, and they had full classes. These were patriotic guys.
Sure.
You can take the Hitler and the Nazi mentality right out of the picture. They were serving their country, just like our guys were serving our country. Like I served 4 years in the U.S. Air Force.
And that's right.
12 years in the Coast Guard Auxiliary, flotilla commander, and two times with the CIA. But that's another story. Pardon me if I'm coughing. We're all getting colds down here because, like I told you, we had a cold snap last week.
Did you say 2 tours with the sea and you stopped?
Yeah, I forgot what
I didn't
I was
hear
going
to say. I didn't hear that. Just want you to know, I didn't hear anything.
Right. My name is Rabbit. I live in the woods and I don't know nothing.
Nothing. Now, picture number 10 ought to just knock your eyes for a loop. That plane is an astonishing aeronautical example of German engineering. A 6-engine behemoth. Big plane.
Yep.
JU-390. And imagine the range of that plane. That's where we're going with some of this story, as much as Harry will reveal. That plane is huge. 3 of them were scheduled to be built. 1 was finished and was flying.
Two
was flying with it, yeah, but not, I guess, as extensively. I don't know, but that's
right.
What I heard.
They were numbered V1, V2, and V3,
yeah.
which had nothing to do with the V rockets. That's
no.
just what they numbered them.
Right.
V1 was the test plane, and I'll be jumping around here as I'm reading from what Pizarro sent, but we're learning. I learned more about this group of airplanes in the last 2 days than I did in the whole 30-something years I've been doing shark hunters.
Wow, all right. I'm looking forward to it. So V1 was the test, the beta version, pretty much. V2
yeah.
would have been the service version, and V3 didn't get finished in time.
That's correct. V2 was built 3 meters longer than V1, so it carried a lot more fuel. And
Got
that
it.
One is the one we're going to focus on. I learned where else this thing was going. It not only flew to Uruguay with Uncle Adi on board, it made several other flights before this while the war was still going on. And
wow.
we'll get to that as, oh, yeah, wow. You can see why I sent emails
yeah.
to you with the title
it.
Of wow.
I got it.
So, anyhow.
All right, photo number 11.
Okay.
11A.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't have put them up there because I'm not going to talk about that right now. But that's in our next magazine that's coming out. 11A
okay.
is Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco, who was a member of Shark Hunters. 11B is Gross Admiral Dönitz with his Knight's Cross and Oak Leaf. He was the only non-skipper to get the Oak Leaf. And 11C, that was my best friend Hess, 21-year-old kid. He was put in command of a combat submarine. That's all explained in the magazine, but it goes to the proof of why U-530 did not have Hitler on board. So,
got it.
I would jump right past that one.
That's okay. Number 12 is a JU-390. That's V2. That's
yeah,
the
look
one
at
that
the size of
yeah,
that thing.
Yeah.
Let's see here. I'm still reading into it. Here others think they have the facts. Others have theories, and still others merely invent their own version of history. But Shark Hunters tells the hard facts, verified and proven, accurate and above reproach. Don't you think the others should do the same hard research before writing a book? Well, they can't.
That's Pizarro you're quoting from?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're looking at that.
Look at the size
12.
Of that plane. Amazing.
Yeah, it's huge. It's the size of a 757. I originally thought compared it to a 747, but that's a huge airplane. But a 757, which I ride on those things quite frequently, this V2 390, about the same size. And it had a beautiful stall speed. It could maintain 80 knots, and its landing speed was 75 knots. And look at all those wheels.
Wow.
It didn't need a runway.
Got it.
So that's preview here.
Well, that goes to what we've discussed before privately, and yeah, this is
right.
That's a really remarkable aircraft.
Yeah.
To be developed, think about it, ladies and gentlemen, to be developed, designed, engineered, and built during the war when Germany was being pounded around the clock for 4 years with so-called Allied bombing and the crazy bomber Harris and his idiot commander-in-chief Churchill. Anyway.
Yeah, what can I say? Anyhow.
I'll say it. You don't have to.
Now, here's my note after something I got from Pizarro. It said, I go on to say, this is in the magazine, the JU-390 V2 carried Adolf Hitler and others to South America, there is no doubt. But the accepted story by the locals in that area is that the plane was broken up the same night by farmhands and the pieces destroyed and or thrown in the nearby river. Keep in mind that this JU-390 V2 was about the size of a Boeing 757. So Pizarro then added in this week, which was last month. I have contact with mail and with telephone with the very last old veterans of the former Luftwaffe transport squadron in 1945. And I asked about the six-motor JU-390V2, which is missing since 1945.
Right.
And I received the answers. They said it is not possible to strip down this big airplane in 1 week, not in 2 weeks, not in 1 month, and certainly not by farm workers. Editor note, that's my comment. We agree. It's impossible that unskilled farmhands without special tools could disassemble such a huge aircraft in one night. You know, as we'll bump into as we go along this further, we are quite sure that that plane flew again after it brought Hitler to South America, and that it's still in existence down there. We're trying to find it. So anyhow, I forgot to put in a picture. Shame on me. There was a picture. Let me rotate. Oh, no, I got them flip-flopped, 12 and 13. Okay. Doesn't matter. Has to do with the same thing.
You got two number 12s. That's what you did.
I do?
Yeah, number 12 is the 390.
Oh,
number
yeah, okay.
12 is Mr. and Mrs. And number 13 is that lonely country road that used to have trees on the left or poles on the right at one point.
Yeah, can't count on me for doing anything right here. Let's look at 13 before we look at 12. Pizarro goes on to say, so it's possible that this plane flew later the same day to Paraguay. That's where we think it is right now. So anyhow, continuing, remember the pilot I met in 1969? The pilot smiled and told me that a Uruguay diplomat said that the big German Reich airplane was landed on the Estancia near the street, landed to the left in the direction of the city of Rivera, and in some days was destroyed. On the left side, near the Estancia, as you have seen, Harry was an airfield, better a grassland, in May of 1945. So that's why this lonely stretch of road, just to the left of the tree line, was a huge big meadow on the Estancia, and we are quite certain that's where it landed. Here's my note. This is all in our next issue.
Uh-huh.
The grassland that Pizarro refers to is a very large meadow on the other side of this tree line on the left. To see 100 more of these photos, go to sharkhunters.com and click on South America Expedition 2016, and the photo of me with my arm around a beautiful Valkyrie. There's the Valkyrie, photo 15.
Yeah, she's the one who wrote to you tonight, right?
Yeah, don't I wish. And it said, with my arm around this beautiful Valkyrie. Sadly, I looked like hell, as I had just gotten out of the hospital a few days earlier after 3 days in a hospital I don't even remember. You remember that when I fell.
That's when Harry, he actually did a dive off the roof, and he got a 9.6 on the dive. It was wonderful.
Probably would have been 10.0 if there had been water there to fall into, but instead I cracked my head on the...
You got an asterisk. He actually, and I don't know how he did it, but those of you who have been listening, remember when that happened and how he went. He says, I'm going.
Yeah,
I'm going.
4 days after I got out of the hospital, I was on the airplane.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the Valkyrie was very cold. It's really not a person. It is painted on wood. Whoever did, you'll notice she's got the blue and white colors of Argentina.
Uh-huh.
Which by some strange coincidence are the exact same shades of blue and white, or I should say white and blue, of the Bavarian colors. Whoever did that painting is one hell of an artist, because, I mean, you look at that, that girl looks like she could walk away and talk to you.
Right, or pick you up and carry you off, one
or
the other.
Or I don't like where her sword is pointing, but I say, I was unconscious for a while. So anyhow, we continue with what Pizarro says. The pilot has never said any more about the final disposition of this big plane. He said only that his new home is in or near New Berlin. It's a little town in Uruguay. Pizarro asked him if the last big plane was destroyed in Uruguay, and he says, Harry, you have seen the Estancia. Yes, I was on the Estancia, and that brings us to photo 12. This is the daughter of the owner of the estancia and her husband. They were very nice people, gave us cake and coffee and answered all our questions.
How did you meet them, Harry? Without giving anything away you don't want to.
Well, this is Martine again. Martine just goes right up and he's asking people, where do we find this one? Where do we find that one?
Wow.
And we got to their home, which is a very small, modest little home.
Uh-huh.
And some place in Uruguay, I have no idea where any of these places
now,
are.
Now, Paraguay is right next to Argentina, and Uruguay is next to Paraguay, right?
Well,
sort of.
Let me look on my map here. Paraguay is directly north of Argentina. Uruguay is directly east of Argentina. And then Brazil is east and north of Argentina.
Okay.
So, Paraguay is where a lot of them wound up, but that's I'm getting ahead of myself here. So anyhow, he went up to the door, knocked on the door, and explained who we were. I was still in the car, and he asked if the lady would take time to speak with us. So then she said, sure. So I came in. Anyhow, they answered all our questions, and I say, well, maybe not in the normal manner. I always ask nice and easy questions before I ask a difficult question. It puts people at ease. So I asked her about the big plane that landed on her father's ranch. Both she and her husband laughed, that nervous laugh like little kids who get caught with their hands in the cookie jar. And then the lady said, that never happened. But then she said, at the dates in question, someone did report an airplane landing on the estancia, and the prefecture of police of the entire province came to her father's estancia. But they found nothing, she says. So then...
Very interesting.
Yeah. If the prefecture of police, which would be like the county sheriff, only down there, their counties are much bigger, and the
right.
prefecture of police carries a lot more power. So then we continue with what Pizarro sent me. Pizarro says, the pilot looked Pizarro in the eye, and in his hand was a very good beer. And he said, destroyed? That is easier said than done. This was not the chief pilot, it was the second pilot, which is the co-pilot, in the meeting with Pizarro in October 1969. He goes on to say, we and the Secret Service think this big plane was never destroyed in Uruguay. Now, if you look at that, where am I here? 16. That is the map, a hand-drawn map. And if you look down towards the bottom, you see Nuevo Berlin, which is New Berlin. That's where this co-pilot retired.
Got it.
You see Nuevo Berlin?
Yeah, yeah. That's okay. Right. To the left of it, it says H-O-M-E, home, R-S, and there's a line to the right,
right,
and you'll see Nuevo Berlin.
Right. That's where R-S lived, and he never would tell me the man's name,
mm-hmm.
and he's dead now. But then you look up, and you see that yellow circle.
Got
right?
it. Yeah.
Okay. That was a grove of trees, and they put a small radio sending unit in there for RDF, for the plane to use as a radio directional finder.
Ah.
And angled up to the northeast, you'll see that road angled up there.
Yeah.
15-kilometer long street. 15 kilometers is about 8 or 9 miles. That was that road we saw there, the dirt road to nowhere.
Got it.
And you see the X circle.
Yeah.
That is the ranch, the Estancia de 19 April. That was a German community that was thriving. It was founded back in the 1920s, and that was where the estancia was, and with the yellow circle, that's where his RDF was, and he came along and he landed about a half a mile inside to the left of that road on a big meadow.
So where were the arrows pointing to an X with a circle around it, past the trees?
Yeah, well, that's a Rancho Estancia.
Gloria. April. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's the ranch. Now, beyond that, the road continues, and to the left or the top of the road, am I correct? That's the meadow, the top of the road, as we look at this?
Along the left side of that angle road, yeah.
Yeah, okay. It says...
See, it points toward Rivera, and we had already talked about Rivera.
Yeah. See, it says, who wrote on R.S. wrote this?
I don't remember who wrote that.
I mean, who drew all these things in here? Pizarro or R.S.?
That's a polite way of saying I can't tell you.
Well, I wouldn't ask if I knew. So you don't know. That means we both don't know.
I know, but I can't tell you.
I wouldn't tell if I knew, and you didn't know.
Okay.
Now, so that meadow is right where you'd see the word Gloria. Look at the G, and then head on up to your right. Follow the road, adjacent to the road. That's how long is that road again?
Or is that Colonia?
Sorry.
I think the
Colonia.
Correct.
Colonia. See how trustworthy I am? I wouldn't even say Colonia.
Okay.
Let's see. 8 meters. Looks like they're drawing an 8-meter width there. Looks like a width side to side. Yeah, that's the road. 8 meters wide, 24 feet, 25 feet wide.
Yeah. Okay. Meter is 3.3 feet. So, it'd be about 25, 26. That was that dirt road. And we drove up it. Those were my photos that I took.
Got it. Now, why wouldn't the plane land on the road? More compacted, perhaps graded once in a while. It's going into a meadow, which could be bumpy. And if I were a pilot, I might try and make that road.
Well, except you saw all the trees and bushes along the side.
Well, they didn't used to be there in 1945.
Well, okay, that's true. I don't know. I don't know why.
And okay.
Probably the phone poles probably were not there either.
No. Whatever. The meadow gives plenty of space for an enormous aircraft like that to come down without sweating it, trying to land on a 25-foot wide road. And those wheels on the undercarriage of that plane got to be 35 feet, 40 feet across, at least from side to side.
Yeah.
So
back in those days, remember all the ME-109s and the FW-190s, they didn't have paved strips in the most.
No, they always took off from meadows.
Right. So I guess they kind of like meadows there in the Luftwaffe.
There it is. All right. Well, that's a fascinating map to look at. Wow.
Yep. And the word there, Vertraulich, I think that translates to not secret, but confidential, different levels.
Mm-hmm.
Vertraulich. So that tells you a lot.
It certainly does. What would the pink circle be and the long arrow to the radio, the radio unit, the direction finder? What would that pink be?
I don't remember. I put that there, and I can't remember why I did it. That meadow down, or that tree line down at the bottom, maybe that's where they put the RDF station, but I can't believe that is too far up the road.
Oh, maybe they had two of them.
That could have been. I got this quite some years ago. See down there, also down toward the bottom, also it says Colonia 19 of April.
Right. It also says Mercedes and a house or a circle with an X in it. Could that be where the Mercedes family had a place? Lower left.
Yeah, I see it. I don't know the answer.
Because they were down there and they built that beautiful estate that Harry took pictures of that we firmly believe that Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun lived in from 1945 to 1955. And it's for sale right now.
Because it's been confirmed.
Yeah.
But, of course, that was south Argentina. That was down
in
Patagonia.
Long way.
And this is in Uruguay.
But the Mercedes family, I don't think, lived particularly near that house, as I remember through all of our conversations. They were there somewhere. But I don't think they lived in the south. Bariloche was way down south.
No, that was built as a resort for their executives to go fishing or skiing or whatever, because the beautiful lake there, Lake Nahuelhuapi, huge lake, great for fishing, and the mountains were right there. We've got pictures of Hans Ulrich Rudel, probably the greatest pilot ever, and Otto Skorzeny skiing in those mountains right there.
And Rudel was skiing with one leg.
Yeah, he had one leg. A tough guy.
Yeah.
That guy. He was down there. He and, let's see, Rudel and Adolf Galland and...
Well, the Hortons.
Well, yeah, but these three guys...
And Tank was there, too.
Huh?
Tank, Kurt Tank was there.
Right. He fled Europe at the end of after the fall.
Right.
He and about 50 aeronautical designers went down there, and they set him up in Cordova City, in Cordova Province, the headquarters of the Argentine Air Force, and he was designing airplanes for the various South American air forces.
He designed the 190, didn't he?
That's correct. The Butcher Bird, it was called, because it was such a good fighter plane.
Yeah.
But the three guys, Werner Baumbach, who was commander of KG-200, the Bomber Squadron 200 that had all the secret planes in it, he and Adolf Galland and Hans-Ulrich Rudel were down there to renovate the Argentine Air Force.
For Juan Perón.
Yeah, for Perón. If you remember in the Argentine or in the Falkland Islands War in 1980, I think it was, that was the only part of the Argentine military that really excelled was their air force. They were one ship short of winning the war. The Brits announced later on, they admitted that if they'd lost one more ship down there in the Falklands, they would have pulled out.
But, wow. They were flying A-4 Douglas Sky Raiders, I think.
Yep.
For the most part.
Yeah, everybody had American equipment on all sides of almost all the wars.
The British took a beating down there, and nobody talks about that much. So the press tried to spin it into basically a, you know, the Brits prevailed because of their superior numbers, strength, seamanship, military abilities. But it was nearly, it was essentially a standoff, and it was very, very close.
Yeah. The one thing that saved the Royal Navy's butt was the SAS, SBS, Special Boat Squadron, came ashore at the airfield where the Super Attendard fighters were. They were the only ones that could carry the Exocet missile. The ones that would, you know, if you had your electronics turned on your ship, it went right to the electronics, and that's
French,
what was killing all the British ships.
A French missile, yeah.
That's correct. The Exocet on the French Super Attendard fighter, which was, if I remember correctly, a Delta wing. But the SBS snuck in there and sabotaged all their Super Attendard fighter, so it had nothing that could carry the Exocet missiles into combat.
Oh, that's why they took... Wait a minute. Now, I think that they did try and introduce them into combat on cargo planes. They dropped a couple from cargo planes.
That I didn't know.
I think so. I remember. But anyhow, that's fascinating. So the Special Forces guys went on the mainland, went on and into the... They penetrated that air base, top secret during this war... And wow, knocked out those the Super Attendard. Wow.
Yep.
That's amazing.
And that's what saved the Brits' butt.
Never heard a word about it till now.
Well, that's what I do 12 hours a day for the last 34 years. In February, it'll be 35 years. Holy cow.
Well, all right. This is an extraordinary document, number 16, we're looking at. And... to the best of our knowledge, I don't know that you're done with the rest of your narrative, so we'll let you do it, please. What do we think happened to the big bird? Don't tell me anything you can't. I understand. We've talked about this, but as far as the public is concerned, we just don't know, right? Is that it?
Okay, we don't know.
That's fine.
And when I come back in March, maybe I'll have pictures of it.
Wow. Well, you'll have pictures of what we don't know.
Right. Or maybe I'll get shot for taking pictures of what we don't know.
We'll remember you, though, Harry. Don't worry.
Boy, that just sets my heart pumping hard there.
I'm telling you. You're going to be fine. And what a coup would that be if that plane were still around, which it probably isn't. If it were, and you were able to find it and get a photograph of it, What a piece of history.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Well, if it's where we think it is, we'll get a photo of it.
If it's still around.
Yeah, true. As long as I can play dumb like I do whenever I go in Germany, I go into places that say, Eingangsverboten. I figure that means Harry's welcome here. And then the police come and start yelling at me in German, and I go into my best down yonder hillbilly. And,
there you go.
Golly, Sergeant, I don't know what y'all are saying, but I bet it sure is important. Isn't this the way to the waterfront? We're in the mountains? Oh, doggone, it gave me bad. I'll be leaving now. And then they're usually happy to get me out of there.
Well, I can imagine Martine going up to those people, introducing himself, and then saying, my friend here just dove off the roof of a building and landed on his head 4 days ago. Would you mind talking to him? He's a little out of it, but he came all the way down here to do some research. And
he's not very well oriented here. Well, I told you what happened when we went to their flagship, the Libertad, in Buenos Aires. That was their big, tall ship, the three-masted, gorgeous, gorgeous old sailing ship.
Uh-huh.
And he went up to the officer of the deck, and very straight up and honest, told him I was from the United States, researcher, etc. Can we tour the ship? And the answer was, hell no, get that gringo out of here, in much nicer terms, I'm sure.
Right.
But then we came back the next day, and I said, here, Martine, just stand there and don't say nothing, just watch. So I went up there, and the officer of the deck was a very attractive young lady, a lieutenant, and she could speak English. So I just showed her my Coast Guard credentials, told her I was a flotilla commander, and asked if it was okay if I look over the ship. Oh, certainly, Senor. She gets this young lieutenant to give us a grand tour of the ship. So
yay.
I told Martine, sometimes you have to bend the rules a little bit.
That's right. Another great Shark Hunters vignette. Amazing. You are amazing. All right.
Well, moving along. Okay, here I'm quoting again. You can look at photo 17, and I'll read now from this email. Pizarro says, I cannot send the rest of the Uruguay story, but I can write this. In the week of 30 October 1969, Pizarro was on order in the area of the city of Paysandú. And we were in Paysandú, and it's a nice little town.
What country? Argentina?
Uruguay.
Okay.
Huge, big German restaurant there with German brewery and winery, and that's where that Valkyrie and I met.
Uh-huh.
So, and then he continues, and in the area of Colonia, 19th de Abril, and on the street in the direction north to the city of Rivera. You can look at the map on photo 16 to see all that. And he said, I spoke to farm workers and old ladies in the Colonia. Many years later, in 2016, on 15 February, Harry Cooper was in the same area and asked other farm workers and ladies. He received, like Pizarro, not the right answers. The answers were only that they heard the stories but did not witness the plane themselves, but the next one down the road would remember. It almost appeared as if this was the standard reply to questions. I heard the story but did not see anything. The next one down the road would remember. That's what he got told, and that's what I got told. Everybody we talked to, except one nice old lady. And
you got volleyballed, Harry. That's called being volleyballed. And that means that those people had their story down. Yeah.
But this one nice old lady, she said she did hear the airplane. There's a picture of her there, and I've got arrows pointing to the moth holes in her curtains. These people are, this was once a proud German farming community. Now they're just, it's a ghetto almost. So,
number eight, I don't see the arrows to the moth holes.
No, this is, that's on my website, not on this.
Okay, I got it.
Pictures.
Right.
So we look at photo 17. This is one of the ladies we talked to.
Mm-hmm.
Nice lady. heard the story, but she knows nothing. There's no Nazis here, she said. But if you look closely, you see the three swastikas tattooed on her forearm, and I think she couldn't have been that forgetful. She must have put that arm up there deliberately, and Martine was practically rolling his eyes out of his head, trying to signal me with his eyes that I should look at her forearm. And that's me there with my glass of fruit punch. You know, they have a lot of fruit punch down there. And that's my $1,000 Nikon laying on the table in front of me that got ruined while we were in that jungle, and I almost died. They had to pour.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they had that to pour water on me for about an hour.
Yeah, that was, you were closer to death there, perhaps, than jumping off the roof and landing on your head. That was a horrible ordeal.
Yeah, God watches out for dummies like me. Well, it was only, what, a week and a half after I got out of the hospital.
I know. I really don't know how you survived that.
It was over 130 degrees, 100% humidity, and we had to actually push through swarms of mosquitoes, and that's where the Zika virus came. But Martina and I were so loaded up with repellent, a self-respecting skunk would have run.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, let's see. The next picture, 18.
Well, what did I know? Number 17.
Yeah,
what
17.
What did you? Could she speak English, or did Martine translate?
Martine translated everything.
Right. Tell me about the conversation.
Well, pretty much that they knew about, and they had a German school there in the area.
Uh huh. What did you say to her? That, all right, when you were a little girl, was there ever talk about a great big plane landing here? That kind of thing?
Yeah, after we got through the formalities and stuff.
Sure,
Then we asked her about the plane, and she said the same thing. She heard the stories, but didn't know it herself, but the people, the next people down the road would know. And her son? No, her grandson, I'm sorry. She lived there with her son, who was probably in his 40s, 50s. And his son, which was her grandson, about 15, 16, 17 years old, came in dressed like a gaucho. So we asked her, how come like a gaucho? Because the gauchos are from southern Argentina.
Right.
And here we are in Uruguay. She said he just really loves the gaucho lifestyle and wanted to be a gaucho.
Oh, he's playing the role, for sure.
Yeah. Cowboys and Indians we did up here.
Yeah.
So... But
all right. How did you approach her? We got just a minute here to the break. How did you approach her about this whole thing? You know, there came a point in the conversation, probably early on, that she realized you were after German post World War II historical information of some kind, and.
We told her that right up front.
Did she act like she had been approached? Is that why they were all volleyballing people from one to the other to the other, that other people had been there researching this kind of a story before? Or was this, what do you think?
Yeah, Pizarro was there in 1969. And back in 1969, there were probably a whole lot of World War II German people living in the area. And so that was the answer everybody was given.
Got it.
And when I went there in 2016, I imagine it just was habit. You know, that's
sure, of course.
What you say.
Yeah. So he was there in 69?
69, yeah.
So that's 24 years after World War II. A 20-year-old kid would have been 44 and from the German military, and there probably were some there.
Oh, yeah.
And in that town, that community, which to this day is probably loaded. That picture right there, what, 2 years ago?
Right, February of 2016.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some of the people still spoke German, so I could get along with my German with them. It wasn't easy, though, because they're used to speaking Spanish, and Spanish you have to speak very rapidly because it takes 10 words to say one word in English. You know, you might say the pencil, they would say something, and I'm paraphrasing here.
Yeah, I got it.
The piece of wood with the lead in it, so they have to speak very fast. So speaking German very fast with a Spanish accent, it's tough to keep up with it. Now, I'm not all that fluent in German. I'm passable. I can get along with it in Germany, but in South America, stuff.
And that's her house, right?
Yeah, in picture 17, we're in our house.
And the outside of the house is in 18?
No, that's another house down the road, but they all look pretty much the same. They're all pretty, pretty shabby.
Can you imagine, though, seriously, if that plane landed there, and it did, obviously, and when the sun came up the next morning, there must have been dozens of people looking at that plane, standing around it. It must have been quite a sight. Unforgettable.
Yeah, I would imagine.
To put it mildly, out in the middle
monster
of nowhere.
Monster airplane that size.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, back with more in just a few minutes. Hang on.